Chapter 13, War and Sorrow. Henry Longfellow's family gathered around him as he read letters and newspaper articles about Hiawatha. Alice and Edith clambered over the arms of his chair, while 11-year-old Charles and 10-year-old Ernest sat cross-legged on the floor. Fanny sat by the fireplace with the new baby, Allegra, in her arms. Messages of praise came in from near and far. Never had a poem been so successful. The idea of the Indian hero, Hiawatha, became so popular that sculptors made statues of the Ojibwe chieftain, and artists painted pictures of him and Minnehaha. The book was translated into other languages, and people all over the world became interested in the American Indians. "I must write a poem about another American subject," said Longfellow. He didn't have to think very long about it. What other important American subject was there? Why, the Pilgrims, of course. Some of his own ancestors had been Pilgrims. When Longfellow looked back into the family records, he found one named John Alden. John Alden had been with the little company of Puritans who came to America seeking religious freedom. They had come in the Mayflower that landed on the shores of Massachusetts in 1620, and they had founded the colony of Plymouth. John Alden had married Priscilla Mullen, and Henry Longfellow's mother had descended directly from them. The love story of John Alden and Priscilla grew in Henry Longfellow's imagination while he sat in his study and thought about it. He decided to tell the story of how they met and fell in love and married. He would tell the story of how Captain Miles Standish wanted to marry Priscilla too and sent John Alden to speak for him. Priscilla sat at her spinning wheel, listening to John Alden tell her how brave and good Captain Miles Standish was. Archly the maiden smiled and, with eyes overrunning with laughter, said in a tremulous voice, "Why don't you speak for yourself, John?" Henry Longfellow finished writing The Courtship of Miles Standish 3 years after his Hiawatha. Miles Standish was full of the life of the Plymouth colony. It told the customs of the Pilgrims, of their homes, their bravery, their wars with the Indians. Miles Standish was another triumph for Longfellow. No other poet anywhere was as popular and as loved as he. He sat in his beautiful and peaceful Craigie house in Cambridge, reading great stacks of mail from admirers. But the rest of the United States was not as peaceful and happy as the village of Cambridge. Henry Longfellow couldn't spend all of his time studying and writing about days gone by. Troubled times were brewing. War clouds were gathering. And Longfellow's two sons were growing to manhood. Charles was 17, old enough to be a soldier. Both Henry and Fanny Longfellow were opposed to wars and fighting. Sometimes in the evenings, when Emerson visited them, they sat talking about slavery and other problems that were creating so much trouble. Charles Sumner was a United States senator by then, making stirring speeches in Washington for the abolition of slavery. Abraham Lincoln was elected president in 1860, and Longfellow was happy and hopeful about it. "This is a great victory," he said. "It is the redemption of the country. Freedom is triumphant." When he and Emerson and others in the North heard that South Carolina was going to secede from the United States, they knew the situation was grave. Other states were leaving the United States. There was war talk everywhere. If Longfellow went to Boston to hear a speaker, the speaker talked of war. If he went to church, the sermon was about war. If he read the papers, the news was about war. "Ghastly," was all he could say. "How can we have peace if people never think of peace?" These were the times when he loved his home best, loved the quiet and peace of his study, loved that hour between dark and daylight, when his workday was finished and his three little girls could invade his study. It was the hour he called the children's hour. Between the dark and daylight, when the night is beginning to lower, comes a pause in the day's occupations that is known as the children's hour. I hear in the chamber above me the patter of little feet, the sound of a door that is opened, and voices, soft and sweet. From my study I see in the lamplight, descending the broad hall stair, grave Alice and laughing Allegra, and Edith with golden hair. A whisper, and then a silence. Yet I know by their merry eyes they are plotting and planning together to take me by surprise. A sudden rush from the stairway, a sudden raid from the hall. By three doors left unguarded, they enter my castle wall. They climb up into my turret or the arms and back of my chair. If I try to escape, they surround me. They seem to be everywhere. They almost devour me with kisses, their arms about me entwine, till I think of the Bishop of Bingen in his mouse tower over the Rhine. Do you think, O blue-eyed banditti, because you have scaled the wall, such an old mustache as I am is not a match for you all? I have you fast in my fortress and will not let you depart, but put you down into the dungeon in the round tower of my heart. And there I will keep you forever, yes, forever and a day, till the walls shall crumble in ruin and molder in dust away. But Longfellow wasn't safe from tragedy, even in his home. As he sat in his study one day, Fanny sat in the library at her writing desk. Edith and Allegra were with her. Longfellow could hear their laughter from time to time, because Fanny was clipping off pieces of the girls' curls to send to their aunts and uncles. As she popped each curl into an envelope with its letter, she held a lighted candle to the end of a stick of wax. A drop of wax would fall on the back of the envelope and seal it shut. It was a hot July day, and Mrs. Longfellow was wearing a fluffy, light muslin dress. While Edith and Allegra stood at each side of her chair, clapping their hands as a curl was ready to go into the mail, the candle flame licked a corner of Mrs. Longfellow's sleeve. Her clothing caught fire in an instant, and the flames shot up toward her face. She jumped up from the chair and screamed as a breeze from the French window made the fire spread over her whole dress. Henry Longfellow heard the screams and opened the door between his study and the library. In panic, covered in flames, Fanny ran toward him. He grabbed a rug and wrapped it around her as she moaned and fainted. Fanny Longfellow never regained consciousness. When the doctor came rushing into the house and saw her terrible burns, he shook his head. By the next morning, she was dead. Henry Longfellow was beside himself with grief. He couldn't rest, he couldn't think, he couldn't talk to anyone. "Your own hands and face are badly burned," said the doctor. But Longfellow paid him no heed. The burns on his face were so bad that even after they healed, he was unable to shave. That was why he allowed his beard to grow. After 18 years of happiness with Fanny Appleton, Henry Longfellow was crushed, heartbroken, lost. Although he was only 54, he felt like an aging man. His hair became much grayer than it had been. He returned to his writing, to his walks, and his talks with Emerson and Hawthorne. Sometimes he got into the carriage and went for a drive. Even though he had three daughters to look after him, he would be a lonely man for the rest of his life. Friends and admirers came from all over the world to visit the great poet Longfellow. They came from Italy, from Spain, from France, from Scandinavia, from Germany and England. Many spoke no English, But that didn't matter because Longfellow could speak so many languages. The housekeeper at Craigie House was always opening the door to visitors and showing them into the poet's study. Charles was home that tragic summer and through the winter, but the next spring, his father had to bid him goodbye. Charles Longfellow had joined the Massachusetts cavalry, and he had to go off to war with his outfit. On a dreary, rainy March day, Henry Longfellow and Charles climbed into a carriage and drove over muddy roads to town. Then Charles was to go aboard the ship that would take him southward. They talked little on the way. Charles knew how hard it was for his father to give up another member of his family. "I'll be back soon," he promised. "The Civil War won't last very long." "Wars always last longer than you expect them to," said Longfellow. After Charles left, the poet seemed quieter and dreamier than before. He didn't argue about war. He didn't make any stirring speeches about abolishing slavery, the way many of his friends did. He just kept his griefs to himself. Summer at Nahant was dull, the town deserted with so many away. Through autumn and winter, the war dragged on. At Christmas time, Ernest and the three girls decorated a Christmas tree, and the poet tried to be merry for their sakes. But they all understood that he was worried about Charles. They were worried about Charles, too, because he was in the midst of battle. Letters and messages from the front came in once in a while. One time they heard that Charles was sick with camp fever. In March, he was made a second lieutenant. By May, they heard he was in camp somewhere on the Potomac River. Another Christmas was almost at hand when the Longfellows heard the news they dreaded most. "Charles had been badly wounded," said a telegram from Washington. Henry Longfellow dropped everything he was doing and journeyed down to Washington. Ernest went with him. Of course, America's most popular poet was recognized as he hurried around Washington trying to find out when the trainload of wounded soldiers would arrive. A great, lusty man in a uniform and high boots stopped him in the railroad station and asked, "Are you Professor Longfellow? Well, I am from Riga, and I have just translated your Hiawatha into Russian." At that moment, Longfellow was more interested in Charles than in Hiawatha, but he chatted politely with the man until the train came in. Charles had been shot through both shoulders, and the doctor said his wounds would need a lot of care and take a long time to heal. His father and brother took him carefully home to Cambridge, where they put him to bed, and the family doctor looked after him.